Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Almost 6 years on, we're still not done with Enron. Sure, the company's defunct, former executives are in jail. All the money people lost, it's still gone. So tomorrow, Supreme Court gets to weigh in. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by The Economist magazine, which tells not only what's happening around the world each week, but why. The Economist, at newsstands, in bookstores, and at economist.com. And by Bank of America, through community outreach, philanthropic giving, and environmental efforts, finding opportunity and embracing it. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity, bankofamerica.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Happy Columbus Day, all. It's Monday, the 8th of October today. Like all other federal employees, the justices of the United States Supreme Court had the day off today. One can only hope they were resting up for oral arguments tomorrow. The marquee case on the docket is listed as Stone Ridge versus Scientific Atlanta. But for practical purposes, it really should be called People Who Lost Money on Enron versus the company's bankers, lawyers, and accountants. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports the case will test how far liability for corporate wrongdoing extends.
At issue is whether investors who lost money when a company fraudulently pumped up its profits can sue other firms, banks, and accountants who allegedly helped the company do the business deals that swindled shareholders. The fraud in this case was relatively small, less than $300 million in revenues. But tomorrow's arguments will serve as a proxy battle for billions of dollars in pending lawsuits against companies that are accused of helping Enron fleece its stock owners. Former Securities and Exchange Commission Chairman Harvey Pitt agrees with two lower courts that secondary companies are not automatically liable.
Should people who never said anything, who had no interaction with investors, who didn't do anything to induce them to trade or not to trade, be potentially liable for billions of dollars in damages? The wrong place to make those judgments is in a federal court. The right place is to make it in Congress.
But Lewis Bograd with the Center for Constitutional Litigation says the law is clear. People or companies that help other companies create artificial profits bear responsibility.
We're not talking about secondary liability. We're talking about primary liability for what the Supreme Court has labeled secondary actors who engage in fraud. If the business community is of the view that the statute reaches too far, then they should be the ones going to Congress and saying, limit the liability of anyone other than the company that is directly dealing with investors. We'll have that battle in that forum.
But business lawyers will argue that if the court makes every company with a connection to corporate wrongdoing liable, the result will be a flood of frivolous lawsuits that will put U.S.-based businesses at a global disadvantage. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Lawyers at Sprint, Nextel, and the internet phone company Vonage were working over the weekend. The two sides announced this morning they've settled a nasty patent infringement lawsuit. A jury ruled late last month Vonage had indeed infringed Sprint's patents and ordered payment of almost $70 million in penalties. Vonage said today it'll pay $80 million to make the whole thing go away. Still not a great day for Sprint, though. CEO and chairman of the board Gary Forsee quit late this afternoon in the face of declining subscription bases. We now bring you the second installment of this fall's auto industry labor negotiations. Last month, 73,000 General Motors employees went on strike for 2 days after GM and the UAW couldn't agree on a new contract. Today, the UAW gave Chrysler a Wednesday strike deadline. Marketplace's Elisa Roth has more.
The union's plan was to use the deal it made with GM as a model for its contracts with Chrysler and Ford. Gary Chason studies labor relations at Clark University. He says the UAW's new deadline suggests things might not be going as planned.
They're trying to create an impression on Chrysler that they had better start talking more carefully and more intensely about some of the things on the table.
Exactly what's on the table isn't clear. Negotiations are private, and neither side is talking to the press. Chason speculates a deadline might push Chrysler to actually start negotiating. But the real problem might be the UAW's tactics. Since Chrysler and GM are two very different companies, a contract that suits GM might not fit Chrysler. Eric Merkel is an auto industry consultant. He says GM's big concern was high health care costs. Not so Chrysler.
They would probably like more immediate cost-cutting measures, such as the closure of plants.
He says it's unlikely a private equity company like the one that runs Chrysler would agree to a contract that guarantees jobs. And he says the threat of a strike might not bother Chrysler anyway.
Chrysler could afford a strike because they are in a position right now where they've got a tremendous amount of inventory out there.
Chrysler's already idled several plants this month. The company needs to clear out some inventory before it makes any new cars. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Ford shares fell more than 2% today, presumably because it's next in the UAW sights. Oil tumbled more than $2, profit-taking, if you believe the analysts. The dollar gained back just a smidge of its recent losses against the euro. The dollar's problems of late might be good for American exporters, but for European finance ministers meeting this week in Germany, it's become a major headache, Marketplace's Sam Eaton reports.
The meeting of European finance ministers will test whether a united front could force international action to tame the euro and boost the dollar. European exports have taken a toll as they become too costly for America and other countries. The European Central Bank is famed for its independence and refusal to lower interest rates. So political pressure, however united, may not be enough to reverse the trend.
They will not get anything done, basically as simple as that.
Ashraf Leidy is chief currency analyst for CMC Markets. He says the falling dollar is a new economic reality, and any political meddling in Europe isn't going to change that. Currency expert Axel Merck says that leaves European businesses with one choice, adapt or die.
If one assumes that this strong euro is going to be there for a while, well, you have to change your business model. And these things take time, especially in Europe where corporations tend to be a bit more rigid, and so they slowly but grindingly will have to cope with that new environment.
Merck says high-end consumers in the U.S. continue to covet some European products like Mercedes and BMW cars, but other products facing stiffer competition, like, say, beer, may not fare as well, since shifting production to cheaper markets could hurt the brand.
If you have an Oktoberfest beer, it has to be brewed in Munich. You can't brew it in China. The market doesn't accept that.
But Merck says beer may be the least of Europe's worries. European banks are heavily invested in the U.S. subprime mortgage market. Getting out of that mess, he says, should be a top priority. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Wall Street was working on this holiday. Investors didn't really do much, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. EU finance ministers may or may not be able to do anything about the sliding dollar, as Sam was telling us. But the cheaper greenback is not standing in the way of deals being done, or at least talked about. Over the weekend, two more American private equity firms are said to have expressed an interest in Northern Rock. That's the British bank that was bailed out of its subprime troubles by the Bank of England a couple of weeks ago. In all, that makes four groups interested in Northern Rock, but this might just be an anomaly because these are tough times in the city, as London's business district is known. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The city has boomed in recent years. Banks from all over the world have flocked to do business here. The whole British capital's prosperity depends on the financial centre. But, says Damien Rees of the Daily Telegraph, the subprime mess means there'll now be leaner pickings for the city.
This credit crunch will make banks more cautious, so the amount of business flowing through London may well fall. So the city is going to be in for a rather more difficult time.
The city may even see a bigger downturn than New York, he says, because of the way London managed its banks in the aftermath of the subprime meltdown.
That system of regulation was tested, and it failed badly.
It failed over Northern Rock. Analysts say when the mortgage lender ran into liquidity problems last month, the Bank of England bungled the bailout, and horrified depositors scrambled in their thousands to withdraw their savings.
It is just a colossal shock. I don't think I'll ever trust the banking system in this country again. And I'm very tempted to do what my mother-in-law used to do and stick it under the mattress.
The run on Northern Rock made Britain look like a banana republic, said the head of Britain's main industry association, Richard Lambert.
This Northern Rock drama was the first big test of the arrangements that were set in place to ensure bank stability. And the outcome was the first run on a bank in England for 150 years. So you can't say it was a complete triumph.
Although a fast-moving, thoroughly modern marketplace, the city is still steeped in tradition. On some official occasions, three-cornered hats and powdered wigs abound. The key figure in the city is the holder of an ancient post, the governor of the Bank of England. That's Britain's equivalent of the chairman of the Fed. He's usually considered above and beyond reproach. But after the Northern Rock affair, the present incumbent, Mervyn King, was pilloried in the press and parliament. Damien Rees says he could soon be looking for a new job.
Mervyn King is a lesser of a central banker, unfortunately, after Northern Rock than he was before. So I think we will be soon looking at the search for a new governor of the Bank of England to take over next summer.
While the chairman of the Fed has been applauded so far for his handling of the credit crunch, the governor of the Bank of England has been holed below the waterline. Howard Wealdon, senior strategist at Stockbrokers BGC, is worried.
A loss of confidence in the City of London and the institutions that surround and serve the City of London, and I include in that the Bank of England, would be a severe blow to the UK economy.
25:40.
About one-third of Britain's entire economic output derives from business services like finance, accounting, recruitment and law. The city is widely seen as the sector's most important locomotive. If the city runs seriously out of steam, Britain's economic growth could hit the buffers. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The latest figures from the United Nations show Cubans have a slightly longer life expectancy than Americans. They do have free universal health care down there, but a new study suggests it may be poverty that keeps Cubans going strong. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
The Soviet Union collapsed in 1989 and stopped sending discount food and fuel to Cuba. Over the next 4 years, Cubans ate a third less calories a day, and they were forced to walk or bike to work.
This was a unique opportunity because we were able to look at what would happen if a whole population is able to reduce their caloric intake and increase their physical activity.
That's Dr. Manuel Franco, lead author of a new study in the American Journal of Epidemiology. He says following Cuba's economic crisis, a third fewer people died of heart disease and diabetes deaths were halved. Franco says the study offers an important lesson to the U.S. on how to reduce health care costs.
Changes have to happen at the whole population level in order to reduce the burden of diabetes and cardiovascular disease.
As Cuba's economy has recovered, death rates related to obesity are creeping back up. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
While there is no guarantee that every business transaction in life is going to be a pleasant one, most companies do at least try to appear interested in how their customers feel. But if you feel more like a lab rat than a loyal customer, get used to it, says commentator Ian Ayers.
Say you and I have been bumped from a flight and there's just one seat left on the next scheduled plane. Who gets it? In the old days, it might have been whoever had more frequent flyer points. But today, airlines are more likely to give the seat to the unhappier customer. Welcome to the wonderful world of CRM, Customer Relationship Management. Here's how it works. If I've already had two flights canceled in the past 6 months, the airline might predict that any further mistreatment might cause me to take my business elsewhere. In fact, having tons of frequent flyer points might even hurt your chances because airlines don't have to worry as much about giving inferior service to loyal flyers who will tolerate just about anything to earn more miles. Harrah's Casino is playing a similar game. It uses oodles of data to predict the pain points accrued by their regulars. A pain point is the amount of money an individual gambler can stomach losing and still come back for more. If you get close to your pain point, Harrah's might send a luck ambassador to tap you on the shoulder and offer you a free steak dinner to get you away from that blackjack table. A lot of CRM is good for consumers. Firms calculate what products and services will make individual consumers happier and go out and provide it. eHarmony does it with potential dates, Amazon with night table reading, and Netflix with your DVD queue. But when firms use CRM to figure out how close to the edge they can go with increased prices or decreased quality, then it becomes a kind of corporate Zoloft smoothing out the highs and lows of consumer happiness. In this new world, you don't have to be a squeaky wheel to get some grease, but you also are a lot less likely to come away truly elated.
Ian Ayers is a professor at Yale Law School. He's also the author of the book Super Crunchers, Why Thinking by Numbers is the New Way to Be Smart. We'd love to hear from you, even if it's only about an old-fashioned way to be smart. Our website is marketplace.org. Coming up, kicking up dust over water rights in the Southwest.
Mark Twain said, whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting. So I see legions of lawyers doing very, very well in the future.
But first, let's do the numbers. With traders and investors largely on holiday, markets were mostly mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials fell 22 points, a tenth of 1%, to close at 14,043. The NASDAQ rose a quarter of 1%, 7 points, to close at 2,787. The S&P 500 fell four-tenths of 1%, 6 points, to 1,551. Sprint settled its patent dispute with Vonage, as we mentioned. Vonage shares jumped a whopping 123% on that news. Sprint stock slipped 2.5%. Freeport-McMoRan Copper and Gold fell 2.25% as investors worried that soaring metal prices could curb demand. Merrill Lynch flopped 2.5% after reporting $5 billion in losses. Chipmaker Broadcom popped up nearly 6% on news that it won a contract to provide chips for Samsung's new 3G phones. The bond market, as we mentioned, was closed today. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. By Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. These reports come directly from the experiences of the members themselves. Angie'sList.com. And by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. Ever hear a song on Marketplace but you just can't place it? Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archive section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to an online store where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, a House committee looks at the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief. The Energy Information Administration releases its outlook for heating fuel costs during the Winter Fuels Outlook Conference at the National Press Club. And the Nobel Prize in Physics is scheduled to be announced in Stockholm. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. At the close on Friday, there were five stocks listed on American exchanges trading above $600 a share. Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway and the Washington Post Company are the two you're probably most familiar with. As of the open this morning, it's six stocks on the list. Google has joined the club, closed at 6:09 this afternoon. But why? That's the question for Brian Cooley at CNET. Brian, good to talk to you again.
Thanks, Kai.
So this is one of those tricky questions with which to start an interview, since the stock price is whatever the market says the stock price is. But what has Google done to deserve $600 a share?
Well, you know, what they did, first of all, was do search really well. Even though they have like 99 other things they do, from maps to mail to documents online and a rash of others, search is the core business. They do it really well, and they really revolutionized it. And secondly, once they did that and started getting a great mass of audience, they sold against it better. The Google AdWords program has been really well executed in a way that no one else can catch up with so far. Not Yahoo, not Microsoft, certainly not the search engines that Google vanquished into memory, like Alta Vista and others. So they have the 1-2 punch of getting us to love their search and then selling hard against it.
When the company reports third quarter earnings next week, are we going to see $700 a share based on incredible revenues and profits?
You know, there's nothing in their revenue picture that I know of that cast a dark cloud. This company is like Apple. Apple is the tastemaker for, you know, frankly, entertainment hardware. The iPod and the Mac are really, that's what their main core focus is. And there's also a layer of luxury goods there. Google, but the same way, has this whole idea of finding what I want and then interacting with it is their whole base. Right now, they are the tastemaker for the sector they occupy.
Let's get to the downside, though, and elaborate on that for me for a minute. What's it going to be that's going to make this company stumble?
What Google has to focus on next is connecting the dots on other platforms. That's one of the keys. In the car, on the cell phone or the smartphone, in front of the television. I don't use Google much in those places. That field is still open for someone to come in and be the killer app of that space. But also, today when you go to get your Google results, there's a good and a bad thing that happens all at once. You type in your term, you hit enter, and it comes back and says 674,323 results.
Right.
And you go, great, a plethora of stuff. But that's also the problem. And I know they know this at Google, that that is a failed algorithm. Anything that returns 674,000 results on something I'm looking for is broken. They have to fix that. Someone's going to fix it. Someone's going to get search so elegant and so focused that I'll get eight results and I'll love every one of them. That's what I really want. So that's the thing that Google needs to be first at. Otherwise, they would very quickly be relegated to second-class status if someone else beats them to it.
Brian Cooley, an editor-at-large at CNET. Thank you, Brian.
Thanks, Kai.
The relative humidity here in Los Angeles today was a skin-crinkling 9%. Not that that, on the face of it, has anything to do with the business news of the day. But if you think about things in a slightly larger context, you'll see what I mean. Average temperatures across the southern United States are predicted to rise over the next 50 years, and precipitation levels are expected to drop. Here in the Southwest, scientists are saying it's going to be especially dry, which will likely have dire consequences for the economy of one of the country's fastest-growing regions. Stacey Vanek-Smith has more.
Climate models by U.S. academics project a 15% decrease in moisture in the Southwest between the years 2021 and 2040. That might not sound so bad, but the same drop in precipitation led to the Great Dust Bowl in the 1930s. Jeffrey Mount directs the Center for Watershed Sciences at UC Davis. He's been researching the drought's future effects on hydropower.
The immediate and most severe impact are brownouts.
Mount says those brownouts will likely become more and more frequent. As snowpacks recede, he says, dam levels will drop and strain the region's power grid.
One of the things that comes with the drought tends to be heat waves, and the demand for electricity is very, very high during those heat waves. And the hydropower system is one of our great buffers there because they can spin it up very fast.
Mount says the Southwest's growth is directly tied to the ability to move water around cheaply to very dry cities like Phoenix and L.A. Mount says the price of the energy needed to move that water will rise stratospherically as states go to the open market to buy extra energy. Those higher prices for water and energy could affect everything from high tech to agriculture. Farming is a $40 billion industry in the Southwest. It also drinks up about 80% of the available water. Farmers are trying to conserve. Nevada farmer Dean Baker watches his massive sprinkler system move slowly over an alfalfa field. He says farmers are using low-hanging rotating sprinklers like these to stretch their water supply.
Used to be we have the big sprinklers that go swish, 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 and this extreme low humidity, it evaporated before it ever hit the ground. These are hugely more efficient with water use.
Some doomsday scenarios predict agriculture will disappear entirely in the Southwest as water prices rise. Mount of UC Davis says that's far-fetched. Still, he says, agriculture will go through wrenching changes.
Eventually, low-value crops, things like alfalfa, and subsidized crops, like cotton, for example, will begin to fade away as the demand for water and the price of water begins to go up.
Agriculture isn't the only business expected to struggle. John Hart is a professor of environmental sciences at Berkeley. He says the region's $3 billion ski industry will be hurt by declines in snowfall.
And our projections are that skiing will become a thing of the past in the western mountains.
Hart says sport fishing will take a hit as higher water temperatures kill fish and stream levels fall. That could take a big bite out of the region's $150 billion tourism industry. And Hart says residents of the Southwest's booming cities could have to drastically cut back on their water use.
Rationing could very well occur, and certain uses that we now enjoy, like gardens and car washing and so on, are going to be curtailed.
Southwestern states are looking for new sources of water to minimize any rationing. UC Davis's Jeffrey Mount says that will mean some big legal battles over water rights. Mount says that will ensure one industry will thrive.
Mark Twain said, whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting. So I see legions of lawyers doing very, very well in the future.
Their northern neighbors could see a boost in business, too. Some scientists have predicted the Southwest climate will migrate north. Farmers in Oregon and Washington have already started replacing apple and onion crops with vines, hoping for Napa Valley's ideal wine climate. And British Columbia has rezoned more than 160,000 acres of forest for agriculture, predicting shorter winters will bolster farming there. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, the Associated Press has gotten its hands on the Iraqi government's report on the Blackwater shootings. It's calling for the private security firm to pay compensation to the families of the 17 Iraqis killed that day, $8 million apiece, $136 million total. In addition to the money, Baghdad wants the State Department to end its contracts with Blackwater in Iraq within 6 months. American investigations, a whole handful of them, are still going on. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 22 points, one-tenth of 1%. The Nasdaq added 7 points, a quarter percent. The S&P 500 down 6 points. That's about four-tenths of 1% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, providing a public platform for domestic workers.
It's very difficult to get an individual in that intimate of a situation to come forward and talk about the possible violations.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.